Hello, I'm Merrick Schneider. Welcome to this podcast of articles from the Wall Street Journal, a presentation of AIRS LA. You're listening to this recording, which is provided for the use of those who are blind or print impaired. Materials or items read on AIRS LA are the copyrighted property of the original authors and publishers. No unauthorized use or duplication is permitted. Today's first article is titled "Mostly Paralyzed, But Happy to Be Alive" by Dennis Prager. David Henderson has "Pacific Grove Tax Dollars at Work." Jonathan Alpert wrote, "Therapists have become too accommodating." Then we have an article, "What's All the Fuss About Bone Density?" by Emma Rosenblum. And we'll follow that up with an article by Robert Granader, "Memories Accumulate in the Basement." All these articles are from recent editions of the Wall Street Journal. So let's begin with today's first one, "Mostly Paralyzed, But Happy to Be Alive." I wrote a book called "Happiness is a Serious Problem" in 1998, which stressed two important insights. First, happiness is not to be awaited, but must be pursued. Second, expectations are a major impediment to happiness. They undermine the greatest source of happiness, gratitude. The more you expect, the less grateful you will be for what you have. The less you expect, the more grateful. In 100 or so talks I've given on happiness, I said, "While I have good reason to assume I will be healthy tomorrow, I do not expect to be. I may have a heart attack or discover a cancerous lump, or I may have a stroke or some other life-threatening event or illness. As a result, I walk around every day with gratitude for my continued health." Back on November 12, 2024, everything I wrote was put to the test. I had a catastrophic fall at home, which left me paralyzed from the shoulders down. The doctors at the hospital told my wife and son that I should be put on palliative care to make my final days as painless as possible. Truth be told, the fall should have killed me. When it happened, my wife was in our upstairs bedroom adjacent to the bathroom. Usually, she would already be downstairs. Had she not been there to see me fall and summon help, I would have been dead within minutes as I landed in a position that cut off my breathing. Tested as they were, none of my views on happiness changed. They enabled me to forestall depression. I still believe happiness is not to be awaited, but must be pursued. And because I have almost no expectation, I am not battling traumatic disappointment. I've experienced considerable pain, both physical and emotional. I've gone from broadcasting a daily radio show, writing a weekly column, lying to deliver at least one lecture a week, and taking at least one listener's cruise a year to a bedridden life. These monumental changes arrived in a split second, and I've replayed the fall in my mind countless times. My condition has reinforced what matters most in my life: my wife, children, and grandchildren, my friends, my mind, and my mission to deliver ideas that better people's lives. Why haven't my views on happiness changed? Because I've never believed happiness is solely a function of what happens to us. Catastrophic events will affect us, but even in dire circumstances, we can and should pursue happiness. It would be easy for me to spend my time mourning, and who would blame me if I did? But my belief that happiness needs to be pursued benefits me and those around me. While my friends and family sympathize with my situation, they still prefer to be around me when I'm happier. Life's traumas come in many forms: the loss of a child, divorce, drug addiction, illness, financial disaster, and depression. It's human to mourn one's situation, but it's our responsibility to fight our way back to a happy life, or at least to make the most of our situation. Life is too precious and too short for self-pity, even under trying circumstances. Whenever I am tempted to consider the unfairness of my condition, I remind myself of the ways in which I have been unfairly fortunate all my life. Even at the moment of my fall, I had the good fortune of my wife's presence, ensuring I received medical attention as soon as possible. It's also remarkable, given that I sustained a hard blow to the back of my head, that I've been able to speak and maintain my mental faculties. Every doctor who has commented on my condition has described my ability to speak as miraculous. None of them were particularly religious. From the day I regained consciousness, I realized I had only three alternatives: death, depression, or perseverance. Since I don't want to die and I don't want to be depressed, my choice is obvious. I will continue enjoying my family and friends, resume broadcasting, writing books and columns, and produce more Prager University videos. And now, Pacific Grove tax dollars at work. I live in this city of around 15,000. Locals call it America's last hometown, and there's something to that term. People are neighborly, and our crime rate is very low. It isn't quite Andy Griffith's Mayberry, but it isn't far off. Last month, though, Pacific Grove's City Council passed a shocking measure that undercuts the warm and fuzzy hometown feeling. The majority approved an expenditure of up to $141,530 for a political consulting firm to help us figure out how to raise taxes. The firm is called Props and Measures, and its proposal is not exactly subtle. We work with our clients to identify shared community priorities and values to identify the elements of a successful revenue proposal. We have built community consensus for revenue measures in hundreds of communities throughout our home state of California and many communities across the country. It continues. The partners and consultants at Props and Measures have experience with numerous successful public finance ballot measures that have raised billions of dollars in voter-approved revenue for public programs, services, and facilities. In short, Pacific Grove's City Council voted to use our taxes to come up with a strategy to increase our taxes. In its proposal, Props and Measures asked, what are the general parameters in dollars of the tax tolerance among residents right now? In short, how likely are we taxpayers to resist further tax increases? The council is clearly looking for ways to tax us further. There are some legitimate ways to do that. One is for members to spend their own funds on a campaign and get others who agree with them to spend their money. That's what opponents of higher taxes must do. But the city council is making us pay for their efforts to figure out how to make us pay more. That isn't only unfair, it's corrupt. In a 1968 article in the Journal of Law and Economics, James R. Schlesinger, later defense secretary under Presidents Richard Nixon and Gerald Ford, and energy secretary under President Jimmy Carter, wrote, "The tool of politics, which frequently becomes its objective, is to extract resources from the general taxpayer with minimum offense and to distribute the proceeds among innumerable claimants in such a way as to maximize support at the polls. Politics, so far as mobilizing support is concerned, represents the art of calculated cheating, or more precisely, how to cheat without really being caught. The good news is that the Pacific Grove residents who alerted me to this have caught the cheaters. Is it too late? Time will tell." And now we have Jonathan Alpert, therapist, have become too accommodating. No one gets in trouble for accommodating, an administrator at a top university told me. He was describing a case in which a student requested extended deadlines and modified grading for anxiety. The documentation was thin, the impairment unclear, but denying the request would have entailed meetings, legal review, and the risk of complaints. Saying yes was the path of least resistance. I encounter the same logic from the other side of the system. In my clinical practice, prospective patients regularly call seeking accommodation letters before we ever meet. Some are explicit about the language they want included. Others ask if documentation is even necessary. I explain that accommodations, when appropriate, follow evaluation, not the other way around. Increasingly, the clinical evaluation itself is treated as a procedural hurdle rather than a diagnostic process. A growing industry has emerged to meet this demand, with some clinicians effectively functioning as letter writing services rather than evaluators. Too often, my profession has chosen compliance over judgment, mistaking accommodation for care. Clinically, accommodation should follow demonstrated functional impairment, an inability to perform essential tasks even with reasonable support. That distinction is now frequently lost. If a patient describes anxiety or ADHD, the clinician assumes impairment. The threshold flips from a proven clinical need or illness to the patient's merely describing the mental health symptoms. This is less an issue of patient's deception than their expectations. Many assume accommodations will be available if they want it, and many therapists oblige. Sometimes that obligation grows out of professional pressure, fear of complaints, or institutional risk. Sometimes it comes from clinicians' wish to be helpful, agreeable, or liked. In some cases, the clinical encounter itself can become transactional, with documentation treated as part of what the client is paying for. Accommodation can simply become a way for a client to buy convenience, such as the ability to keep an otherwise prohibited pet in an apartment or to get more time on tests. Whatever the motive, the effect is the same. Clinicians and patients treat accommodations as the goal of a clinical conversation rather than one possible conclusion. At elite universities, accommodation rates have surged, with increases tied primarily to mental health diagnoses such as anxiety, ADHD, and depression. Recent reporting indicates that nearly 40% of Stanford undergraduates are registered for accommodations. Harvard reports roughly 21%, up more than 18 points over the past decade, with similar increases at Amherst and Brown. This is not due to a sudden epidemic of disabling illnesses. It's because saying yes is easier, safer, and cheaper than saying no. The same incentive structure shapes workplaces. Employers report rising accommodation requests tied to mental health claims, while disability disputes account for a growing share of employment litigation. Approval carries little cost. Denial carries legal, reputational, and administrative risk. Therapy was never meant to function as a governing model for companies and schools, but its language now substitutes for institutional judgment about standards, expectations, and limits for student and employee behavior. Concepts developed to help patients tolerate distress have migrated into policy where they serve the opposite function. Rather than help people learn to be resilient in an unpredictable world, institutions use these concepts to try to eliminate stressors. Validation replaces challenge. Protection replaces expectation. Ordinary struggles are reframed as pathology, and accommodation becomes the default managerial response. This shift reflects a broader cultural change as well. Americans increasingly treat discomfort as harm, struggle as injury, and resilience as something to be explained away rather than cultivated. But institutions are not slaves to cultural whims. They decide which values to enforce. The choice of many schools and companies to convert therapeutic language into policy has hardened these cultural preferences into rules with administrative force. For people with legitimate impairment, accommodation remains essential. Properly applied, it allows capable people to meet standards they would otherwise be unable to reach. But when accommodation expands without clear boundaries or meaningful verification, its credibility erodes and skepticism grows about even well-founded uses. Those with genuine needs ultimately pay the price. If this logic continues unchecked, institutions won't be more compassionate. They'll become less demanding, less credible, and less fair. Standards will survive on paper, but not in practice. My own profession is to blame. Clinicians usually serve as the gatekeepers of accommodation. When clinicians stop exercising judgment on these matters, institutions follow. Therapy was never meant to function as a licensing authority for exemptions from ordinary demands. But when clinicians treat accommodation as care rather than as a narrow clinical determination tied to functional impairment, we train institutions to do the same. In the process, we exchange credibility for compliance. Now, what's all the fuss about bone density? A couple of months ago, I was out to dinner with my sister when she turned to me with a serious look. "Emma, I'm worried about something," she said, warily eyeing my pasta bolognese. She paused long enough for my mind to go to a dark place. "Our parents? One of the kids?" "It's your bones," she said dryly. "I'm worried about your bone density." As far as I know, my bones are fine. In fact, the only bone I've ever broken is my thumb in 10th grade when a friend kicked a soccer ball into my hand at close range. Since then, my bones have done their job without a hitch. My sister reminded me that I have small wrists, and since I'm generally a lazy bum who doesn't exercise much, I should be thinking more about bone density. But she noticed that I don't eat enough protein. After I pointed out that bolognese is meat, she directed me to Instagram dietitians for advice about protein intake. I played dumb just to annoy her. That's what sisters do. But of course, as a 40-something woman, I was already well aware of the stranglehold such topics have on my peer group. We're currently living through an explosion of interest bordering on obsession in perimenopausal and menopausal wellness. Protein, weighted vest, heavy lifting, more protein. I have friends who choke down Greek yogurt by the bucketful, who eat handfuls of grilled chicken at a time, who deadlift their own body weight. Google searches for bone density hit an all-time high recently, which is around when I started seeing the term pop up on my Instagram feed. Admittedly, we are a generation attempting to age differently than our brittle-boned mothers and grandmothers. But my real and digital lives are now filled with women explaining in excruciating detail what I should do to strengthen my skeleton. Did you know that jumping is very effective in building bone density? Should I hop around New York City like a kangaroo in a weighted vest? One of my mom group chats recently turned to strength training, and I copped to finally succumbing to peer pressure and buying weights on Amazon, 5 pounders to be exact. You have to start somewhere, right? But instead of being applauded for my effort, I was roundly shamed by my friends. "Throw them out," wrote one. "Definitely doesn't count," wrote another, a petite woman who said she lifts up to 50 pounds. "Heavy lifting is much more effective than weighted vests," she continued. "I love her, but my friend is neither a medical professional nor a fitness coach. For guidance, I consult with Dr. Karen Teng, the author of It's Not Hysteria, Everything You Need to Know About Your Reproductive Health, But We're Never Told, who offers a more measured take. Bone density is a real medical concern, she says. As women age and produce less estrogen, bone mass decreases, which can lead to osteopenia, thinning of the bones, and its more serious cousin, osteoporosis, which comes with a high risk of fracture. For too long, women going into perimenopause and menopause just drifted along, suffering through symptoms. Eventually, they maybe found out they had frail bones and were put on medicine, said Dr. Teng. The increased awareness around this is good because some of it is preventable, but there's so much information, it can become a source of stress. Recently, there has been chatter about DEXA scans, an X-ray test that measures bone density, recommended for women over 65, or over 50 if you have risk factors. I've watched cheerful come with me to get a DEXA scan videos on Instagram, followed by 20-somethings dissecting their results. None of these women were anywhere near 65, but who knows, maybe a few of them learned that their bones need help. The ultimate trendsetter, Gwyneth Paltrow, was diagnosed with osteopenia in 2010 at age 37, and she's still on the front lines of the issue. She joked with Amy Poehler on her podcast that she will gag down protein 70 times a day, a commitment I am not willing to make. So what should I do? I asked Dr. Teng if I have to deadlift my own weight, hop around the block, or get a DEXA scan, and she laughs and says, no. If you're not at high risk, you don't have to do any of that, she says. For the average person, it's just lifestyle modifications. Some weight-bearing exercises, some strength training. Dr. Teng also looked into the studies about weighted vests. Maybe if you wear one for 8 hours a day, it might help a little bit, but who's going to do that, she says. To be fair, she has not met my crazy friends. So I won't buy a jump rope, and I won't take creatine. Instead, I'll go about my life as before, carrying my groceries home, using my 5-pound Amazon weight, and eating pasta bolognese. Even so, my sister has already suggested I buy a vibrating plate. Apparently, they're great for building bone mass. A middle-aged influencer told me so. And now, memories in the basement. My generation has a boxes in the basement problem, one that stretches from our parents' home to our own. I was born in 1967, and my parents are in their 80s. In their basement are boxes of mementos from my childhood. There's 2 boxes of football cards, the smell of my old hockey equipment, the sound of the desk safe where I kept my silver dollars all transport me back decades. They bring me to the 1980s when I lived in the Midwest. These objects sat in my line of sight as I dressed for school and did my homework. Every time I returned to my childhood home, my parents asked if I'm ready to take the boxes labeled things Robbie used to care about. What am I going to do with letters from camp, pictures of old girlfriends, and the front page from when John Lennon was killed, I asked. Now, my wife and I are packing up the house where our own children grew up. For 18 years, do you want to keep this became, we'll deal with it later. What to keep and what to toss is a battle, and our basement is ground zero. It is the place where the detritus of our children's accomplishments has settled. Like the bottom of the ocean, it looks serene from a distance, but making waves reveals treasures here in the form of memories long past. My wife is not sentimental about my treasure collecting. She calls me a hoarder, but I prefer the term family archivist. I fill a box with keepsakes and she labels it things you shouldn't be keeping. As we prepared for our move, she asked, "Why is this so hard for you?" I told her the fear beneath the clutter, that if I throw these things away, the memories will go with them. Without the artifacts, the moments might dissolve. "You'll still have the memories," she promised, "even without the stuff." I hope she was right. So I began to toss. "You have to admit, it feels good to purge," she said. I was reluctant to agree, but she had a point. Soon I was throwing away fifth grade report cards, old concert tickets, and an unidentified baby tooth in a Ziploc bag. My next trip to the Midwest will be different. Instead of arguing about when the boxes are coming home, I'll quietly empty them into the trash, keeping only the few things that still spark something real. But I'll leave a final box tucked away in my parents' basement, waiting. Not because I need what's in it, but because it reminds me that some memories don't need to be moved, sorted, or purged. Maybe that's the point of all these boxes. Not to preserve every scrap of our past, but to know that some memories do not have to be held in our hands to stay with us. That brings us to the end of today's article. I'm Merrick Schneider, and I look forward to being back soon with more articles. Thank you for listening.